everyone. Welcome to the Sleepless Cinematic Podcast, where we explore our shared love for watching and discussing movies recorded in the late after-work hours, often in lieu of a good night's rest. I'm Julian.
I'm Emilio.
And I'm Madeline. The three of us are colleagues at a Midtown Manhattan music school. Yes, music is what brings us together, but movies are what keep us together talking at the end of the night. So we've decided to create some order to this ongoing trend and record these conversations, considering an overarching theme while we cycle through five distinct categorizable guidelines for engagement.
This podcast is an evolving thing. Changes and tweaks here and there will most likely happen, but while we do it, you, the listener, can count on the three of us doing what we've grown to love, foregoing sleep for a discussion about movies every other week.
And this week, we continue our current cycle of movies related to unique Best Picture winners at the Oscars with a category we call Two Shot, where we focus our lens on two movies with some striking commonalities, some obvious, some not so obvious, and discuss their themes, characters, and other salient details that stood out to us. And those two movies this week are 2004 or 5's Crash, directed by Paul Haggis, and 2018's Green Book, directed by Peter Farrelly. And the connection between those two movies, I mean, some listeners, you're probably already putting the pieces together, but
definitely
the connection between those two movies is, you know, not the most pleasant connection.
Yeah, I think up to this point in our own podcast, we have been focusing on movies I think we can speak with some excitement about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe even if it's a film we haven't seen before, we're excited to discover them. Mm-hmm. But I think these two movies kind of have a bit of a scarlet letter on them. Some maybe even in the moment, but I think as time has gone on, these have almost achieved an infamous level of notoriety amongst Best Picture winners.
Yeah, I don't even think it took that much time. I think it was pretty right out of the gate for both of them. Mm-hmm. These are two relatively close together winners that were both like kind of derided for having what were perceived as glib takes on racial themes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are two very different movies, and we'll get into it in a moment. I think, you know, the experience of watching one is quite different from watching the other.
Oh, definitely.
I would say so, too.
Yeah.
I actually saw both of these films in theaters when they came out. Mm-hmm. How about you guys? What's your exposure to them?
I had not seen either of these movies. I couldn't really remember when you guys asked me if I had seen Crash, because, I mean, this Crash is not to be confused with David Cronenberg's Crash, which
oh,
I have seen.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
So I was very much like, I don't know. Let me think about it. And no, I hadn't seen either of these. I had pretty intentionally avoided Green Book. And yeah, this is, you know, here I am. I finally watched it as well as Crash, but I had not seen either of these prior.
How about you, Julian?
I had not seen either of these movies prior as well. And I think Crash, you know, I had been loosely aware of. I just kind of knew it was a movie that had won Best Picture and eventually knew that it had been kind of an upset winner. But then Green Book, I guess I have a little bit more of an interesting context for that. I was aware of it at its time, and it was a pretty low priority mm-hmm. on my watch list at that time. It was just, you know, I got the impression of it being like, okay, this is a decent movie, but it's not like the creme de la creme of what's out there right now.
Sure. I think there were a lot of other films that felt more like prestige films.
Yeah.
You were kind of trying to check off maybe some boxes of what was out there and what was maybe going to be a real player at the Oscars.
Yeah. And yeah, that exactly. There were some higher priorities for me for, you know, Oscar watching and also just simple interest.
Yeah. It was just a really strong year for movies.
2018. Yeah. 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 I think I was just aware of it. It was on my radar, but I didn't make a priority of seeing it. And then it started winning awards and almost as soon after, I remember it started getting some kind of negative press. And at that point, I was kind of like, okay, it wasn't a priority for me. I'm not going to make it one. But then I sort of thought at the Oscars that year, like, okay, it's in the pool. I didn't really think much was going to happen. But then it won Best Picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yep. I was like, well, that and funny enough, Coda were the two movies in the last mostly 15 years, everything from The Hurt Locker onward. Those were the two movies I had not seen when they won the award.
Previous to them winning the award.
Previous, yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I just hadn't seen it. And I think that had we not arranged to have this conversation about the two, I was not going to make a priority of seeing either movie.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, I remember, so when Crash came out, I think it was in my last year of high school. I'm trying to remember, but it was something of an event movie. It was, okay. And what was kind of interesting is, I think it had a bit of a reputation as like a water cooler kind of film.
What does water cooler mean?
Meaning it's just a lot of people are seeing it. It's like a good movie that to just have a conversation
exactly.
with another person in your office, at your school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And that I think that for a while, that was kind of its reputation, at least when it first came out, is that it was a movie that was going to evoke some kind of response in you mm-hmm. when you watch it, one way or the other. I can't say for sure, but I think on the strength of that, it did very well in the box office. It's mm-hmm. it's actually a very modestly budgeted film, but it has a pretty remarkable cast.
Yeah.
It's got a very stacked cast of extremely well-known and popular actors from that time. So I think on the strength of the subject matter as well as the cast, I think it was just one of those movies that people were making time for. My first reaction, if I'm remembering correctly, was I felt like there were some very powerful scenes, and I remember thinking that it was fine, but it also at the time felt a little heavy-handed. That was my big takeaway then, and I have not revisited this movie on purpose, because I didn't think I was going to really enjoy it again if I watched it a second time. And what I'll say is, whether you like this movie or not, it's a real experience watching it since our climate has changed vis-a-vis race. It's just a fascinating document of what it must have been like to talk about race back in 2005.
Yeah, I mean, that statement, I'd be curious to, put that to other people who were like conscious film goers at that time and see if they agree. But I guess now, I mean, Madeline and I were the first time watchers.
Yeah,
here.
So first time watchers. And tell me what you guys think of this.
So, we've all discussed this, just amongst ourselves, that among the three of us, I have a bit of a reputation as the most generous critic of the bunch. And bearing that in mind, I would like to say that I thought Crash was an unparalleled, glistening pile of shit.
I hated this movie.
Yeah.
Like, really, really strongly. I think that this is definitely my most disliked movie that we've covered.
Yeah.
But I think maybe, like, the most disliked movie that I've watched in a long time.
Yeah. How does it compare to The Whale?
I honestly definitely dislike this movie more than The Whale. And this came up in my conversation with my partner, who has been requested to be referred to as Dougie on this podcast.
Dougie.
Because we were talking about The Whale in context of this movie because of Brendan Fraser being in both. And I'm like, well, I hate The Whale. But at least Brendan Fraser has something to do in that movie. He's at least like, he has an assignment and he's like giving a performance. And I mean, that's true of some actors in this movie, but Brendan Fraser seems to kind of just be there in this movie.
Yeah, I think that. So I would agree with you guys. This is not a good movie.
It's bad.
What I'll say though is I'm trying to look at it from more of a kind of a 30,000 foot view, because I am trying to kind of understand how this movie became a Best Picture winner.
Well,
not just maybe say whether this movie is good or bad, but maybe try to understand why in God's name a movie that really doesn't work on so many levels, why this hit the zeitgeist clearly enough to win Best Picture.
Yeah. And I know, Julian, you famously have been going through Oscar wars, and so I'm sure you can provide some amount of insight on the answer to that particular question.
Yeah. So it's funny you say zeitgeist, because I mean, I think that's a pretty generous term for the body of the Academy at that time.
But I think to your point, in the wider realm of the population of America and the world.
So what I will say, I'm a little bit older than you guys. This movie was a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
It actually was.
Yeah.
Which, whether we think it's good or bad, is I think is interesting. It's telling that a movie like this made almost $100 million and was as popular as it was and won all of these awards.
Yeah.
What about our culture allowed for a movie that is this flawed? Because it is truly flawed.
Yeah, flawed in a lot of ways.
To really reach these levels. I mean, when we talk about Best Picture, it's literally like a snapshot of... Well, and maybe we'll get into this a little bit more. Yeah. I oftentimes think of a Best Picture winner as being something of like a flag that just kind of is there to tell you this is a representative film of quality, of what was happening in movies at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm with you guys. Yeah. Like, this is not a good movie.
but you're like, why?
But I'm trying to engage with it a little bit from that perspective. But well, sorry, you seem like you have something.
Page earmarked.
Yeah. Well, it's before I even get to this earmarked page though, my guess, and I was just a kid at the time this movie came out. I would have been 8 years old. Like my interpretation is sort of, it must have had something to do with like post 9/11 attitudes in America.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of how this movie is marketed in some ways. Like I think even in the description of the movie, at least on like iTunes or Apple TV or wherever you rent it, is like in a post 9/11 America.
So. Yeah. Maybe it's just that people were curious to ponder what it had to say with the sprawl that it has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe people were curious, like, does this actually, you know, serve as an effective microcosm of our state in the country right now? Or like, does it reflect, you know, ingrained feelings that we're trying to work through relating to different communities, you know, relations between one ethnic group and the other.
Yeah.
I also think there is this, like, because of this particular storytelling style, which I will henceforth refer to as the Love Actually.
Or like the omnibus. You used that term before.
The omnibus story for Magnolia. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or so, I like Love Actually. Though, this literally has like whip pans that kind of go like one door closes, another one opens.
Exactly.
A car goes down the street and what do you know? We're at a crime scene.
Yeah. Yeah. But also this like idea of all of these interconnecting stories that I think in some ways are kind of like shoehorned together. Like we have to make them connect. This is Los Angeles, but we're still in such like a small, supposedly like the way that we see it, all of the stories that we see are interlapping or overlapping with each other.
Yeah. 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 It's like a character in one actually makes their way into another or maybe a third story.
Yeah. And in some ways it'll be like a twist, like a kind of the very end.
Well, the very beginning of the film, it does that whole thing where it's like, oh, we're going to put you right before what is supposed to be an emotional climax.
And then we're going
to
go back.
And then we're
going
to go back to yesterday. And we're going to see a Persian man try to buy a gun.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I was just going to say is that I do think that I could see somebody, even if you know nothing about the content of this movie, but knowing that it's got this crazy stacked cast, as you alluded to earlier, and knowing kind of this storytelling style, I think that this was maybe interesting to people like go to a theater and see like here's 10 different like interlapping stories.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of in the, to me, honestly, watching this movie felt a lot like watching Magnolia about race.
Yeah.
Even the kind of it happening over the course of what, like 36 hours, 48 hours or something. Mm-hmm. And I also think, have you guys seen a movie called 13 Conversations About One Thing?
No.
No.
Okay. Never that was another movie that felt a lot like, and actually thematically, both movies have to deal with like a mugging or a crime that happens against a particular woman and how it alters their perception of life.
Yeah.
I was thinking of that and also thought of Traffic. This movie felt a lot like Traffic.
That came up in when I rented it on YouTube and that came up in the recommendations when it was over.
Yeah, Traffic. This was a lot like Traffic. Mm-hmm. It's going for something. Like it is trying very hard to paint Los Angeles in a very particular light.
Yeah.
Sorry, you've had the book page open. Go for it.
But yeah, so this page that I have earmarked, I mean, not only is it a page in Oscar Wars, it is the first page of Oscar Wars.
Ooh, so that was very easy to earmark. You just open the cover.
Very easy, but... You know, I think it's saying something that this is the first sentence of the book. The Oscars, it should be said at the start, are always getting it wrong. 24 centuries after Euripides came in third place at the Athenian Dramatic Festival, Brokeback Mountain lost Best Picture to Crash, and the outcry will probably last another 24 centuries. Thank you, Michael Shulman.
Yeah, yeah.
One more relevant point to make just about like the state of the Academy when at the time that Crash wins is this is like, you know, a group of kind of stagnant membership for some time. And I mean, this is, you know, the quote I'm about to read refers to reporting that happened in 2012, but that, you know, does reflect the time before then too. All right, here's the quote. "But the Academy's race problem had been under intense scrutiny since 2012, when the Los Angeles Times reported under the headline Unmasking the Academy that the nearly 6,000 person membership was 94% white and 77% male, with a median age of 62. People under 50 represented just 14% of the roster. African Americans made up 2%, and Latinos were less than that. The executive branch, Hollywood's gatekeepers, was an astounding 98% white. The paper had painstakingly tracked down members, finding that some hadn't worked in the industry for decades, including a bookstore owner and a nun. The expose included stinging assessments from black artists, including director Bill Duke, who called the Academy an elitist group with no concern or regard for the minority community and industry."
Not to go too off topic, but I'm so curious as to that nun story.
Oh,
Me too. That is mentioned in the book. It's, I forget her name. It was this woman who had been in, starred in like a movie with Elvis in,
oh, wow,
in the 50s.
Back in the 50s. Okay.
And like 3 years before, you know, going into a convent in Connecticut.
Wow. And fascinating.
But that tells you a bit about the Academy leading up to 2012. And I mean, that covers the period in which Crash wins.
Yes, 2004 and 5 are indeed before 2012.
Yeah. And Crash, like, just to talk about, you know, this weird duality of its dates, like, I think it premiered at Toronto International Film Festival in 2004, but did not get a wide release in the United States until 2005.
Yeah, right. I kept seeing this, cited with different years wherever I looked it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say, so we've already shared our general feelings that we find this to be an extraordinarily problematic movie.
Yeah.
There's something really myopic about the movie, and it kind of tells on itself like right away. Like the very first words, I had to write them down.
Absolutely.
The very first words that Don Cheadle's detective character says, "It's a sense of touch. In any real city you walk, you know, you brush past people, people bump into you. In LA, nobody touches you. We're always behind this metal and glass." He's referring to the fact he's sitting in a car when he's saying this. "I think we miss that touch so much that we crash into each other just so we can feel something." It kind of admits that there is something about where they are geographically that is supposed to heighten this sense of racism. But what I'm asking is, like, is this a movie that's just about race relations between people in LA? Is there something we can see here that is supposed to inform how humanity at large operates? I think it's really trying to talk about something at least specific to America. What I found, though, is that the longer it goes on, the more it really just feels so contrived and forced.
Yeah.
And all these stories feel like they have to tie themselves up just neatly enough for some sense of resolution. And it felt like this was really writing that was born not from experience, but from a thought exercise.
That is it right there. That is my number one issue with this movie. And I'm sure, did you guys, because it's like first paragraph on the Wikipedia page, but did you guys see the kind of origin of this?
Yeah,
so you saw it. Did you see kind of the origin of, in the director and screenwriter's mind? It's baffling.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry.
Go for it. No, please.
I feel like I just
Wikipedia
need to read
aggregator.
It straight off of here because I see it and I'm like, that is ridiculous. So writer and director Paul Haggis was inspired to make the film after being carjacked by two African-American men at a Blockbuster Video on Wilshire Boulevard while driving home from the premiere of Silence of the Lambs. Afterwards, he began thinking more about the impact of race, ethnicity, and class in American society. So this...
There's more to that quote that I think is good to know, too.
Okay, you keep going.
Yeah. He later stated that he wrote Crash not simply to criticize racists, but to bust liberals for the idea that the United States had become a post-racial society.
To be entirely, or to be only slightly fair to Paul Haggis, is I did read where that is cited from, and he includes himself in that. So it's not so much a like, you know, I'm a conservative who's trying to bust the liberals' chops. He's like, he was essentially saying like some liberals think that racism has been solved and this is me saying that is not true.
Yeah, I read that too. And it's just, but I mean, even that conceit too, that just, I feel like that's a blatant admission that he does not trust his audience. That it, you know, it's just like, I sort of think like, where does this idea come from that we're living in a post-racial society? Like, you know, what narrow bubble of people was he talking to that believed that?
Well, again, I hate to say this, I mean, and maybe this really came later, but when Obama was elected president, there was this weird feeling that kind of permeated where people were like, we have a black president. Something must be better.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's,
I've never once believed that myself, but it's a real thing. There's a very strange groupthink that happens. And this is actually one of the things that I kind of want to get to, because I don't think this is a good movie at all.
Yeah.
It almost feels like when white filmmakers make films about race, they're like graded on a curve.
Oh, totally.
That they get points for just...
for even trying.
For even going for it. Mm-hmm. Now, in all fairness, that is a very difficult and tricky thing to do. Mm-hmm. And there's a part of me that looks at somebody like Paul Haggis and goes, well, his heart seems to be in the right place. He is trying to tell people that we need to be mindful of the type of biases and prejudices that we might be taking with us, you know, on a day-to-day basis, but not really addressing, or thinking that because we haven't experienced something that would unlock those biases, that they're not there. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that that I actually think is totally cool. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is not a good movie.
White people need to be thinking and talking about race, because like racism does not go away when we ignore it, when we turn a blind eye to it. However, that does not necessarily mean these people need to be making these huge movies, like, to explore these concepts really without even like a lot of input. Like, they don't even have a black screenwriter with him. I believe the only black producer is Don Cheadle. Mm-hmm. They have like multiple other white producers. Like, this is a movie that is made so much by white people. Mm-hmm. Trying to center stories of other races, but I think doing it really clumsily.
Very
like,
clumsily.
Writing it from a perspective of like, he supposedly like was kind of holding interviews in town halls and like his living room, like interviewing people of various backgrounds. And while I respect that, I'm like, go out into the world. Like, you live in Los Angeles, and I don't know anything about his social circle, but it seems to be like maybe he is mostly interacting with other white people.
And Scientologists at the time.
Yeah. He was a Scientologist.
Yes, he was a Scientologist.
And also worth noting, too, that Paul Haggis he has fallen into severe disfavor over time.
Oh, yes, he has.
He was found guilty of sexual assault.
There were multiple women, I think, that came out with stories, unfortunately.
Yeah, and so it's like, as if it isn't clear already, that by talking about this movie, we are not endorsing Paul Haggis.
Definitely.
Yeah. And like, I need to read this quote to you guys that I pulled when he's talking about his writing process, because it's, in my opinion, disgusting is the word that I'm going to use for this. In the first 30 minutes, we're going to reinforce every stereotype. We're going to tell the audience, I know you're a big liberal, but you can laugh, because we all know Hispanics park their cars on their lawns and Asians can't drive. Relax. Oh, no one's going to know you're laughing.
That's, yeah. I mean, well,
this is a direct quote.
And when you watch the movie,
whose film won Best Picture?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, just to speak of like the state of the film industry, too, that like, that the victory of Moonlight was a great, like, positive watershed towards, you know, better representation in the Academy, and a step away from people with views like the one in the quote you just read, a step away from people like that getting such a high platform.
What I felt constantly watching this movie is like kind of a gleefulness whenever they are writing in these like racist quips.
Gleefulness.
Yeah, like in that it seemed like the writers, Haggis included, felt like they got to write racist comments and get away with it.
Oh,
because it's part of the overall story. Yeah. Oftentimes it's played as like the joke at the end of a scene. Mm-hmm. Like when Don Cheadle, like the scene when he's hooking up with his partner and he answers the phone and it's his mother.
Yeah.
And that's the scene that ends with his comment about like
parking on the lawns. Yeah.
And so oftentimes these scenes end with like, all right, ha, that's the joke.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it just felt really, really gross to me that seemed to be more of a focus of the movie than the actual like progression of solving racism in 36 hours.
It's really interesting too, because that quote that you just said recontextualizes a lot, because what I felt was happening when I was watching the movie was that nobody gets off scot-free.
Yeah.
Everybody in the movie is racist. It really felt like Paul Haggis or the screenwriters went to go see Avenue Q and heard the song Everyone's a Little Bit Racist. And we're like, what a wonderful concept. We're going to get rid of all the humor that honestly makes that song very relatable, by the way. And we're just like, we're going to create a situation where nobody gets out unscathed. Not even Shaniqua Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the very end of that movie, she's yelling and apparently starting this cycle all over again.
Yeah. And she's like maybe one of the few characters throughout this movie that seems to be like, you know, in spite of the odds that Matt Dillon's cop character puts against her, keeping like a sense of cool about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a virtuousness too.
And a virtuousness. Totally. Yeah. And then even in those last moments of the movie, she is not exempt from that.
Yeah. And it felt like that was what happened with the Don Cheadle characters. Totally. That was his moment to be like, yes, I'm a racist too in some way.
Yeah.
And his partner has that moment earlier in the film where she's having an argument with the woman who ended her and, you know, gets into all of that.
Totally.
And then that woman also has a moment later in the film.
Where she calls somebody
fat. Exactly. And it's everybody in the movie has some moment where everybody is racist about somebody, but that there's also some glimmer of hope in everybody.
Yeah. And I wanted to read it that way, but as the movie progressed, I was more and more soured I started to think more that it was being played, that a lot of these comments were being played for laughs, and that someone had the excuse of writing this movie to be able to say these things. And then I read this quote and I just feel like it kind of confirmed that thought process. And I also think, to your point, that this movie kind of presents all of these different levels of racism as being equal, where it's like, you know, somebody's comment to somebody about their weight or is the same as like a racial slur.
There's all of these moments in the movie where like someone makes a generalization about another only for it to be corrected.
Mm-hmm.
The contrivance of it is just too transparent.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, this is a movie that's entirely built on stereotypes. It's like every single one of these characters, none of them have any real depth. They are all played only, written only surface level.
Yeah. Question for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen a movie that really reveled in the use of stereotypes and had it work?
So
I can think of one.
Interestingly, I mean, there's a movie we've already discussed that didn't do it nearly as copiously as Crash did, but I think did work because it was blatantly satirical. And that movie is Polyester. Because, you know, there's like that montage in the beginning of the movie where like, you know, those teenagers are going around smacking people with a broom from a car.
Right, right.
And like every person that they smack is some kind of overplayed stereotype of an ethnicity. But it's clear that what John Waters is trying to do from the way that it's displayed, it's that he is lampooning the persistence of these stereotypes in American culture, that he himself does not, you know, see these people so narrowly.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and that's, the magic word there is satire.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that there were a lot of moments in Crash that felt like if they had been written as satire, you know, depending on who was writing the moments, it might have worked.
Yeah.
But they were played as self-serious.
Yeah. And also you're saying depending on who was writing it. I do think that I'm not saying that somebody can only ever write about and write dialogue for and write stories about their own race. I'm not saying that. However, when you're getting into these sensitive topics, it is vital to have that perspective of a person with this lived experience.
Yeah.
And I think that's missing from this movie. And I think that there are examples of this same kind of situation where the stereotypes are written by someone with that actual experience, where it's handled more sensitively.
Yeah. I mean, the example that comes to mind for me is Do the Right Thing.
Yeah. Like Spike Lee.
Yeah.
He's totally like the guy for this.
In Crash, it's like it almost feels like Paul Haggis is trying to do his version of the racist rant moment in Do the Right Thing and just sort of disperse it over the course of 2 hours. Mm-hmm. In the hands of somebody like Spike Lee, who's telling a very personal story and actually trying to shine light on police brutality, mm-hmm. it just plays so differently. It really feels like it's creating a heightened milieu, but something that still is servicing a story with a message.
Yeah.
And it's really odd. I mean, this movie just really fails on so many levels.
Yeah.
And another movie that I was thinking about, not really in, on the topic of stereotypes, but just a movie that I thought about, and this was Fruitvale Station.
I was thinking of that too.
Yeah.
I haven't
seen
that.
That one's great. Yeah. That's really, really excellent film, Michael B. Jordan, based on a true story and of a police shooting. And There's the cop that ends up doing the shooting. I was like, how do I keep Fruitvale Station spoiler free when it's based on a true story? Spoiler alert for Fruitvale Station. But the cop that perpetrates the shooting is kind of is similar to Matt Dillon's partner.
Ryan Phillippe.
He's young and he's green and he's presented as kind of being in over his head and how this was maybe an accident. But Fruitvale Station handles it so much more delicately because it's coming from the perspective of a black person.
Mm-hmm. And like worth noting too, that Fruitvale Station, I mean, like, you know, the act of violence that is at its climax really comes at the end of the movie after what has been like these 90 minutes of basically a slice of life story.
Yeah.
Day in like a day or a few days, I can't remember, in the life of the victim of, you know, this evil act. And, you know, it's just, you know, up until that point, it's a really sweet movie to watch. Mm-hmm. And you really feel for the guy. Yeah, this is a movie that engages with that topic so much more sensitively and sincerely. And I was thinking while watching Crash, at a few moments, there are scenes there where I think, okay, I get that this is coming from a real world problem. This is something that is worth addressing in art. But this movie is just missing the mark. And there are a lot of other works that handle this subject matter with the nuance that it deserves.
Because it's the real world problem that these screenwriters read about in newspaper.
Exactly.
Or like interviewed somebody about, and not something that they've ever been even close to the experience of.
I think the two characters that represent that offense are the Ludacris and Lorenz Tate characters.
Yeah.
Because very early on in the film, there's a scene where they come out of a restaurant and immediately they are complaining about how they weren't served on the level of other white customers. What kills me about that scene, and it's weird, it's like, it's not like these guys cannot be intelligent, but it's like every thesis of the movie has to come out in these characters. And then the flip on it is that they are talking about how people around them feel unsafe and that they should be the ones that feel unsafe.
We're in more danger here than they are.
Yes. But then suddenly they have to cheapen it by actually making them carjackers.
Which is, again, like the true story that this is based off of, is that our director is Brendan Fraser.
Yeah. And it's weird because it's like there are ways that those points can be made in a film that I think would be interesting. But then it's like to have it monologued
at you first and then like essentially
erased.
Undermined.
Incredibly undermined in that moment.
I was watching this movie alone, but at the moment when they're like, so why aren't we scared? Maybe because we both got guns. I like almost spoke out to my computer and said, really?
Oh no.
Like that was just like, you know, for them to just, you know, complain about being stereotyped and then embody a stereotype.
Yeah.
It's just, I thought that scene,
it's really bad writing.
It was terrible writing. I mean, I honestly thought this is one of those moments where if it had come from a satirist, it might have worked better. Like that scene,
this was like a Key and Peele sketch.
It felt like a Key and Peele or like a Chappelle Show sketch. Like, you know, it felt like if you took the script and put it and framed it from the lens of those writers, it could have, like, very little could have been changed and they, you know, the parody would have been more effective.
Yeah, totally. Now, one movie that I also couldn't stop thinking of when I was watching this now is American History X. Have you guys seen that movie?
No.
No.
Okay, so I think American History X is a much more effective movie about racism and the way it permeates people's lives what that movie does that this movie doesn't do is it takes one of these stories and it just zooms in.
Yeah.
And it just keeps zooming in and it continues to flesh out these characters and then create scenarios where this kind of racism that feels ingrained in a character can slowly be eaten away at to the point where this person feels like they've changed. The American History X character, Edward Norton, his father, he's a firefighter who's killed by somebody who he's trying to save, a black drug dealer, I think. There was a fire in the building and they were trying to get into a unit and this person ended up killing him. And that was the incident that radicalized him, essentially. Mm-hmm. And in this movie, there's kind of a similar setup where the Matt Dillon character feels like his father was... his life was really taken away from him by like a government initiative that felt like it was unfairly servicing people other than his dad. And that he was carrying around this hatred in the world because of that. A movie like American History X just goes like, okay, great. Here's one character. This is an interesting situation because this kind of thing does happen. And we're just going to really explore it. That's what really, really doesn't work about this movie is it wants to be all things to all people. It wants to hit every quadrant, every ethnicity. I don't know, man. It's just so frustrating because you can make a movie about this kind of topic. And the filmmakers of that movie were white as well.
Mm-hmm. On a very similar note, I was thinking with that Matt Dillon character, a lot of Martin McDonagh's film, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Yeah.
Because, you know, of the Sam Rockwell character in that movie, who is a racist cop who also goes through, you know, a very lengthy cycle of change. That, you know, Sam Rockwell character is also caring for an elderly relative, his mother in that case. And this is a character too who, you know, is presented as like an evil person who is given by the film an opportunity to be humbled by circumstances and experience some change. What Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri does more successfully is that it engages with the fact that this subject matter is ugly and messy, and, you know, dealing with it, you have to be very careful, you have to be very nuanced, but it, you know, it tries to make some sense of it and accepts the fact that maybe there's some sense can't be made of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I also just want to say that I watched this movie the same day that I finished watching Beef, which I know you guys haven't watched, but is really, really excellent. I highly recommend. It's very big right now because we're recording this not long after the Emmys and the Golden Globes. Mm-hmm. And this is a groundbreaking show when it comes to diversity, particularly like this centers like the two main characters are of various Asian descents. And Ali Wong made history as the first Asian woman to win an Emmy for a lead role category based on Beef. And so to finish Beef and then later that day start this movie, which after that initial Don Cheadle line scene at the beginning immediately jumps into racism towards an Asian woman, was really, really jarring.
Yeah. So I could understand that.
Ahead of the conversation, I put together a list in my notes of other works that deal with similar themes better than Crash.
Okay.
And we've already discussed a number of the movies mentioned, namely Fruitvale Station, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. But another four movies on my list that I do want to point out, which all come from black filmmakers at that, is If Beale Street Could Talk.
Mm-hmm. Same year as this. Oh, no, sorry. Same year as the other movie we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Continue. Yeah. Widows, also that same year.
Oh, Widows is great.
Widows is an amazing movie.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Queen and Slim, which is the following year, 2019.
I did not get to that one.
Neither have I.
That is a under-discussed movie. That movie deserves a much bigger platform. And a very, very recent movie, American Fiction.
Mm. Yes, yeah. Which is still on my list.
Oh, and another thing too, not a movie, but a television show, The Wire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I was thinking which predates this film. Yeah, so there's definitely like a precedent. There's something that could have been referenced to be like, well, how did they handle this?
Yeah. And that show notably comes from a white creator, David Simon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would point to American History X.
One more thing that I want to mention is When They See Us, which is the Netflix show based on the story of the exonerated Central Park Five. Because the kind of the structure of that, because they have to focus on each of the now men that are involved in this incident. And so you often get like a full episode on this person and then a full episode on this person. So it also has these like interlocking stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I think this movie was originally meant to be a television show.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, we were spared from, I guess, more of this.
Yeah. I think Crash in general is just extraordinarily disappointing.
Yeah.
Viewing experience in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And it is a fascinating document about what was celebrated. Yeah. It still is a really strange thing for me.
There's some, well, actually we kind of came into the conversation considering this question of, okay, we're talking about unique Best Picture winners. What do we consider a standard Best Picture winner? I mean, there's some like really good ones in the aughts. I mean, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. I think that's great. Deserving. No Country for Old Men. Very deserving.
Very deserving, yeah.
I think The Hurt Locker, I would argue, is a very deserving movie, too.
When we talk about more recent films that feel just like a standard Best Picture winner, I think of Spotlight, too.
Oh, yeah. That's also like weirdly kind of an upset winner because, I mean, in a good way, though, because Spotlight, I think I was not expecting that movie to win, but when it did win, I was kind of like, okay, yeah, that's, I can get behind that.
Yeah. And it's also, it's, I mean, it's based on a true story, which I think also is a little bit of Oscar catnip when somebody.
Absolutely.
It's not like a super flashy movie.
Yeah.
But it's like a very solid film. Yeah. And when you get to the end of it, you're like, that was a really good movie.
And it's like they were giving the award that they didn't give to All the President's Men in 1976.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
You can say that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another stacked year, if I remember correctly.
Believe so. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this would not fall in the category of of average.
Of standard.
Of standard.
Crash, it's, you know, below simply standard Best Picture winners. It's like, you know, forget that it's not deserving. It's just the movie is utter crap.
Huh.
And like outside of even the Oscars, I would still have been like, what garbage?
Yeah. I just wanted to make a tiny bit of space. If there's any detail in the movie that jumps out to us and we just want to rant about it for a second.
Okay. So
is there anything? Because I have a couple things.
I gotta go through my list. You guys go first.
Well, one, we haven't talked in much detail about this and it's only icing on the cake at this point, but the portrayal of that Persian shopkeeper.
Oh my God. I blocked that out. Oh my God. I haven't thought about that
Farhad
once.
Farhad is his name.
This whole conversation, I have not thought about his big moment.
That,
oh my God.
Like, I just thought the portrayal of that character.
You hit it.
I was cringing watching most of that.
So his character gets in a big argument, thinks that the Michael Pena locksmith is trying to cheat him. He uses that expression a lot. And as a result, doesn't get the door fixed. That ends up leading to his store being ransacked. And because he was alerted by the locksmith that it needed to be fixed, the insurance company won't be covered and all of that stuff. That
it's kind of convoluted.
Definitely convoluted. But in all of his rage, ends up going to this guy's home.
And I'm like, thank God we don't have phone books anymore.
Oh, yeah. I know.
Also, I'm sorry.
That detail was so obnoxious. He couldn't have put that on the passenger seat.
Exactly.
It has to sit right on the dashboard.
And what I was thinking, I now forget Michael Pena's character's name, but it's something like pretty generic, like Daniel
Ruiz.
Are you telling me that in Los Angeles, he's the only Daniel Ruiz?
Yeah, for sure.
Or did this man go through the other 50 Daniel Ruizes in the phone book before finding this one?
This one. I know for sure.
Yeah.
What I will say just on that small little detail, Michael Pena, I've heard in an interview, he's very insistent that if an audience sees him, that they also see or hear him addressed with a Latino name, which I think is very cool.
Yeah.
I wish he was in better hands with this movie.
I think Michael Pena is one of the only actors that comes out of this like looking okay.
Yeah.
Well, that scene with his daughter was one of like where he's, you know, comforting her before bed. That was one of the very few scenes in this movie that actually kind of worked for me.
You know what? And even that has this really annoying music that's trying to telegraph to you.
The score is very annoying.
Yeah. It's the most generic cliche thing.
It's very
I also
very
just quickly want to say like the last 15 minutes have the weirdest music underneath them that I'm like, I pause it at one point and I'm like, there's 20 minutes left with this music. Like it feels
it
so
going.
Much like it's trying to play you out and it just keeps going. It's so infuriating.
That's where I felt like it was trying too hard to go for a Magnolia vibe. Cause I mean, Madeline, you haven't seen Magnolia.
Yeah.
Right?
I still have not.
Magnolia does the same thing. But by the time you get to that moment in Magnolia,
yeah.
you are ready to be washed and bathed in this music.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're just in such better hands
yeah.
when you watch a movie like Magnolia.
Between like the score and the visual depictions of LA, this just felt like it was trying to be a cheap knockoff of Michael Mann's Collateral.
Yes. Even yeah. though it was filmed on weird digital video, looks better than this and feels better.
So much better movie.
So much better, yeah.
And then speaking of Magnolia, I mean, well, like without spoiling what happens, there is this kind of fantastical thing that happens in Magnolia that, you know, unites all of the characters.
It snows in LA.
But then in Crash, it snows in LA.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And it's just like kind of like, what?
That's
like,
what made me think of Magnolia right yeah. away. I'm like, oh, interesting. Something odd falling out of the sky.
Yeah. And at this yeah. point, it's like, you know, I mean, this is very overdoing the conversation to say this. Even though we've already, you know, dealt a bunch of spoilers for Crash, this is the kind of movie that, like, I don't care about spoiling.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, like, we spoil yeah. it for you, but also the movie spoils itself for you by being crap.
Yeah. yeah.
We were talking about that scene, though, where
yeah.
Farhad, like, hunts down Daniel Ruiz with his gun.
Yeah.
And goes to Daniel's house at the moment that Daniel is coming home, and he essentially is going to go shoot the guy. And earlier in the movie, Daniel has told his young daughter, who's 5 years old, that he has this like special cloak that he's going to give her, that's like given to him by a fairy, that's going to protect her from bullets. And so she sees this interaction and she's like, daddy's in danger and he doesn't have his cloak and I have the cloak, so I'm going to run out. And this movie tries to convince you that Farhad then shoots this 5-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Baffling. I see it and I'm like, this movie sucks so badly. I do believe this movie would kill this child.
It's such in its own fantasy world about what people will do in the name of race rage.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. Even if an impressionable 5-year-old girl hears that she has an impenetrable cloak,
yeah,
she's not going to run out in front of a gun
yeah.
or not be like, what's happening? And be yeah. really scared. No. It's not happening. It really isn't.
And I'm sorry, Farhad, your plan is bad, because if there were bullets in this gun and you did even just shoot this man and not his daughter, this is broad daylight.
Yeah.
There are witnesses everywhere.
Everywhere. This dude just fired a gun at this man and his daughter.
Yeah.
Somebody call the cops, arrest this man.
Yeah, because
arrest him.
Yeah, someone should have heard the gunshot.
Yes.
Even if they don't know that there has been no harm, but he just like leaves. It's fine. She's fine.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
She's not gonna be traumatized at all.
But see, he has to be able to have that conversation later with his daughter in the ruins of his store to tell her that there's an angel that came and protected him. Yeah. And
just this Pulp Fiction style divine intervention.
I wrote the same thing. I literally wrote in my notes, what just happened today is a miracle, and I want you to fucking acknowledge it.
But yeah, so you go on thinking that that happened, and that for a movie that has otherwise been grounded, you know, in reality, in, you know, big quotes,
big.
You know, that suddenly it has its moment of fantasy. And like, why is that happening? And then you find out that Farhad's daughter had, you know, in that first scene, or like maybe second scene of the movie where they're in a gun store, that the red box that she bought was full of blanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, but how would he never have noticed that?
I don't think he reads English.
And then he also they kind of try to explain it away as that he's not looking to understand how a gun works or understand what he's putting in the gun or what he's going to be shooting.
Yeah.
It's just that he has a gun. And again, too, it just speaks to like very lazy characterizations about people, not just a store owner or not just a Persian man. Oh man. So,
yeah.
Okay.
I think I've blown off most, if not all, of myself. My steam. Okay. One brief final note about Crash before we transition. Is, you know, to blow off a little more steam, that Sandra Bullock character, I like hated every second with her.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm going to say one thing.
Yeah.
That I thought that her speech to Brendan Fraser was the only moment in that movie where they were going for something and it kind of worked.
Can you remind me of what the speech
is? The speech is that she was crossing the street,
right,
these guys.
That she was like, I was afraid.
I was afraid in this moment. I didn't act on this. And so now this other racist feeling that I have, I'm going to act on it right now because I didn't before. And look at what happened. What I'll say is that was maybe the only scene in that movie that contained a kernel of something that I felt was actually something that I know many people personally have felt.
And can I say that I feel like this, the reason why maybe this on some small level kind of worked for you and maybe for others is because the screenwriters and directors are white and Sandra Bullock and her character are white. And maybe you can write about your own experience and thoughts better than you can about people that you don't know.
I think that's perfectly said.
And also, I mean, it's interesting too that Sandra Bullock a few years later won an Oscar for another movie.
This is the warm up for
it really is.
You know, she won an Oscar for The Blind Side, another movie with questionable racial politics.
Definitely.
Yeah, just the warm up for that.
Did anyone else think she looked like Eva Longoria in this movie?
No.
I 100% like, I look at the kind of the way that they styled her and like the particular way they did her makeup and her hair, and I was like, she looks like Eva Longoria in this role.
Well, Desperate Housewives was kind of like a hit show, and yeah, she's a desperate housewife.
Yeah.
And the one other like moment, or I guess, you know, type of scene in Crash that kind of worked for me was stripping it of its context, those scenes where you see Matt Dillon's character at home and actually caring for his ailing father.
Oh, sure.
Those were some moments where I'm like, okay, like if you forget about who he is, like I can feel for what he's going through here.
Again, Matt Dillon, characters.
White character.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
Well, I think we're all getting ready to transition into our next topic.
Absolutely,
and then as, you know, a little bit of glue to connect them, thinking about, again, about the Oscars themselves, it's worth noting too that Crash won Best Picture, and that's not the only award it won. I believe it also won
editing. I think
what
editing? I think it was editing
and original screenplay.
Yeah,
and the connection there is that sometimes Best Picture winners, somewhat frequently, you see Best Picture winners that don't have this all-out sweep that movies like Titanic or Lord of the Rings: The Return of the King have,
or Everything Everywhere All at Once,
or that they don't get that. You know, they win a few things. They win maybe like one of the screenplay awards. They win supporting actor or actress, or they win like editing, something technical like that. And I think that's a pretty good segue into discussing Green Book, which had one of those kinds of nights at the Oscars in 2019.
It's absolutely always interesting, I think, when a Best Picture winner does not also win Best Director, which is the case for, I think, both of these.
For both of these films,
For in 2006, Ang Lee won Best Director for Brokeback Mountain, very deservingly.
Yep.
And then in 2019, Alfonso Cuarón won Best Director for Roma.
Yeah.
Which
that
I think
was like Brokeback Mountain was in 2006.
Yeah,
that was like kind of the front runner.
It seemed like the favorite to win, with a little wink, because the favorite was nominated.
Also, I think, pretty well positioned to do well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so like Green
also
Book
had an upset.
Yeah.
Olivia Colman winning.
Yeah, well, that was a good upset, though, yeah. I thought that was a surprising but deserved win. But so
Glenn Close didn't think so. Her seventh nomination without a win.
Yeah, and so now,
what are we going to do? Sorry. Anyway, I continue with your point.
Yeah. So now we are discussing Green Book, which came out 13 years after Crash. And then at the Oscars that year, that won not only Best Picture, but Best Supporting Actor for Mahershala Ali and Best Original Screenplay. And this is a ceremony, like the ceremony itself, I can say a little more about. This is, you know, it's just a few years ago. It's 5 years ago. And I was in my senior year of college at the time that this movie won Best Picture. And what my college, Sarah Lawrence, would always do for the Oscars was they would have a viewing party. There would be like a student run, like some club would run a viewing party where we'd watch them live. People would get together in like a cafeteria or a small theater or something. And I did that every year I was there. Going to a small liberal arts college, you can imagine what some of the reactions were like when that movie was revealed to be the winner. And I think that, some loud boos, you know, in the room watching that, there was disappointment, but at that point in the night, it was not incredibly surprised disappointment.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, building up to that point, I mean, I think we already alluded to this. There were several other movies nominated that year that were more worthy of the Best Picture prize should it have gone to them. So Green Book was nominated against Black Panther, BlacKkKlansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, The Favourite, Roma, A Star is Born, and Vice. Interesting pool. About half of it I agree with being there. I would say, let me put this question to you both. What was your favorite to win of that bunch?
It's a good question.
Yeah,
because that's a good question. In going through it, there are still some movies on here that I've not seen.
Yeah, I'm missing a couple of these.
So yeah. I really liked Star is Born. I am in the camp that Roma is pretty overrated.
Mm.
I liked Black Klansman a lot, but it's so funny. Like, looking at this list, I don't really see a movie that I'm like, this is the clear winner.
Yeah, like, I look at this list, and I mean, I like The Favorite a lot. I'm a big Yorgos Lanthimos fan in general. This is not necessarily my favorite movie of his, but I still think it's very solid. I don't know that it would be my pick. I mean, I think from here I would give it to Black Klansman from this list. And Dougie agreed with me and said that, I mean, kind of as a legacy award, I think at this point for Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm. Who did win for adapted screenplay that same night.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, at the time, I mean, I think, yeah, looking at this, it's an interesting pool. It was, like, a little hard to single out a clear winner, but the one in my heart that I was feeling was Black Panther. And that, you know, the reason being...
That would have been a unique Best Picture winner.
It would have, yeah. And it would have been, I think, a very deserving, progressive win. And that movie, to me, I think, is the greatest achievement of the Marvel Universe. I mean, maybe it says something that I forgot it was a Marvel movie frequently while watching it. And I should clarify, too, that these days I'm not an MCU defender. I think it really, like, the MCU needs to end and it won't admit it.
Yeah.
But, like, this, you
this
know,
was the real, this was the zenith right here.
This was the zenith, yeah. I think. Like, I followed those movies more closely at that time, but I think there was, you know, just more quality to look for there mm-hmm. then. But yeah, I would have been equally happy with Black Klansman winning. At the time, I was also, you know, if The Favorite or Roma had won, I would have been happy with that.
And, you know, we're talking about all the movies that maybe we thought would have been more deserving.
Yeah.
Green Book was the one that won.
Yeah. And so that, like, in the awards season, I mean, it felt a little bit like a dark horse. At the Golden Globes, Green Book won Best Picture, Musical, or Comedy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was the point when I realized, oh, okay, this movie has some momentum.
I don't think of it as a clear comedy or yeah. clear musical. I'm sorry. I know that distinction just feels very outdated.
But yeah, so it won that award. And that was when I realized, okay, this has, at least in the award circuit, some momentum.
Yeah.
But then it was after that time that the negative publicity, at least in my experience of it, started to build up, where there was this tweet that had been unearthed from co-writer Nick Vallelonga,
yeah. who also is notably the son
yeah.
of the main
of
Tony Lip, who's the main character mm-hmm. or one of the two main characters in the film.
Yeah,
and he was one of the big engines to get this movie made.
And a tweet of his from around 2015 was unearthed that was Islamophobic in nature, and it was, you know, playing
directed
off
towards a particular presidential candidate.
Yeah,
time.
It was playing Ooh. Off of something Trump had said.
Yeah,
and but then so that happened, and then, you know, I don't remember if there was any more like concrete thing like that.
There's
that I
one
came
more,
across, but oh yeah, and I think I know what it's going to be about Don Shirley, about his relatives.
About his
yeah.
relatives. There's yeah. also another one, which
oh,
is
okay.
that
go for it.
I don't have it in front of me, but I'm just remembering from having read a little bit about it that Peter Farrelly he used to do this thing on the set if he felt like there was tension happening, which is extraordinarily inappropriate. He has not been considered a predator, but mm-hmm. it just what he was doing was highly inappropriate.
Yeah.
I would say it's kind of on the level of something like David O. Russell
mm-hmm.
in that yeah. in that sphere, where it's yeah. just like a director that has this tendency, and you're just like, really? Oh my
yeah.
god! Okay.
I don't know if we need to say what it is, but I did read what you're
yeah,
talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, yeah. If anybody wants to, they can look it up. It's yeah. it's not great. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, and so, yeah, there's that Peter Farrelly thing, and then also there was controversy over the depiction of Don Shirley, who's the character played by Mahershala Ali in Green Book, because I think it was that Nick Vallelonga had an agreement with Don Shirley himself to not contact relatives or something like that.
Yeah, something to that effect, or that
yeah.
what I read too is that he didn't want to be around to mm-hmm. see it. He was like, after I pass away, this is yeah. something that I give you my blessing to sort of tell the story.
Yeah, I think I found the quote here. Okay, yeah, Tony Vallelonga's son, this is on the Wikipedia page, Nick, and the film's co-writer, acknowledged that he was sorry that he had offended members of the Shirley family because he did not speak to them. He told Variety that Don Shirley himself told me not to speak to anyone and that Shirley approved what I put in and didn't put in. And so, yeah, there's that controversy that...
It's a little bit of he said, she said.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that Don yeah. Shirley's living relatives were not contacted to consult about his portrayal in the film, and that Mahershala Ali was, you know, he did not know this himself and apologized to the family afterwards too. And I think this all came out before the Best Picture win. And so it just became pretty clear at the time that it had the momentum to win Best Picture, possibly, that it was a movie that was just, you know, like, I mean, I keep using this word glib, but kind of a glib portrayal of a white man and a black man becoming, you know, starting out as an unlikely pair and becoming friends. And it's just kind of like, you know, we've seen this movie before.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah.
I think you talked a little bit about maybe your greater opinion of the film just now. Maybe revealed it a little bit. What did you guys think of that movie?
I'll let you go first. I've been talking a while.
Yeah, I think that, so I told you, Emilio, that I watched this. I watched Crash first, and then I was going to watch this, and I have not watched this. And you said you thought it was good that I did it in that order. And I would agree. I think that I hated Crash so much that I was like, there, nothing can be this bad. And I do think that that remained true.
Yeah, Green Book, for me too, it did not upset Crash.
There is a lot that I don't like about Green Book. I don't like it as a movie, but I did not hate it nearly as viscerally as I hated Crash. And there are some parts of it that feel watchable just purely based on, like, I find just Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali very compelling actors in general. Mm-hmm. Whether or not these are, like, they're certainly not either of these actors' best performances, but I think they're still decently entertaining portrayals, even if they're not most likely very accurate. I found this movie to be watchable in a way that Crash was just not.
I would agree with that. I mean, yeah, it's like Green Book. I think that I didn't hate the movie, but, you know, I didn't particularly like it either. It was just, you know, it felt very familiar in its mm-hmm. arc. And even if it is based on a true story, it just felt like it was going for something that, you know, has, like, by different means been done before. And it's just, you know, it feels like a kind of a cookie cutter movie in a lot of ways, especially given the, you know, historically white Hollywood's depictions of, you know, glib depictions of solving racism in the past. You know, the movie that Green Book is often compared to, which I have not seen, is Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I haven't seen that since I was a kid, but I mean, that's how I've constantly referred to this movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Emilio, where were your thoughts when you saw this movie in theaters, and then where are your thoughts now after rewatching?
So, I read and heard a lot about the controversies and some of the issues that were kind of creeping up about this movie. I honestly went to go see this movie
because of the controversy.
Because of it. I was a little bit curious. I was like, I was interested to see what was going on. So I came out of it. My wife was there with me, and we both looked at each other and we're like, I feel like we've seen this movie before, but we didn't think it was that bad. This wasn't a great movie, but this was fine. I kind of liked it. And then when we sat down to watch it again, put on Crash, and then put on Green Book, and ask myself, I'm like, does this just feel like a wonderful breath of fresh air after what I just saw? You know, because it,
yeah.
Like, if the bar is in hell,
exactly, yes,
yeah.
And so I did. I kind of said to myself, stop, like, go through your notes, think about it a little bit. And you know what? I don't think this is that bad of a movie. I really don't. Mm. I completely understand why some people would have objections about it. I completely understand why there are some things about its origin that feel a little bit problematic. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I also don't think this movie should have won Best Picture.
Yeah.
That's one thing I'll say. Like, yeah,
I think that's a given.
I don't think this is a movie that rises to that quality.
Yeah.
That being said, I think there are some immensely watchable and oddly good touches to this film that I'm ready to defend.
Okay, well, like, well, why
yeah,
don't
let's,
you?
Yeah, let's have a couple of examples.
What are,
I mean,
what
I
are some
I,
good touches?
I think, yeah, where you say not that bad, I would agree with that statement in a general sense, in that I don't think it was, but I think I would, like, put the tone set, I would be like, it's not that bad. That I mean, that's where I'm at.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's kind of like, if this movie had no Oscars momentum, I would have nowhere near as strong feelings
about it. So I think that that's the worst thing that happened to this movie, is that it won Best Picture. Mm-hmm. Because I think if this movie existed outside of the vacuum of what it won, I think people would look at it and say, yeah, this is perfectly fine. Oh, yeah, okay, it's a little problematic here and there. Or maybe we need to just consider this movie as the opinion of the son of one of the characters. Mm-hmm. And that would be that. To be honest with you, that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah,
I'm choosing to engage with it that way because I've already made my peace with the fact that, yeah, this is not a Best Picture winner.
Yeah.
But on the level of Crash, or even I think on the kind of greater level that this movie is looked at, I don't think it's as big a transgression. That's me. That's everybody has a different threshold for seeing certain things or seeing certain things portrayed. And yeah, and you know what? What works for some people may completely not work for others. And that's that. But yeah, if you guys have any questions, like, please go for it.
I'm curious. I mean, I think Julian, you're gearing up for something, so I'll let you go first. But I'm just curious as to like, what are a couple of things that you liked about this movie?
Okay. This is a response to having seen it right after seeing Crash. So, but I also took a step back and was like, how does this really make me feel? I thought that the way that racism was addressed person to person in Crash was kind of deplorable.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought that the way that Green Book handles the way people are racist to one another was kind of incredible. I think it's very, very well done.
Well, it's like maybe what you're getting at is, so like watching the movie, I think the part of it that I was most into was the first roughly 30 or 45 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Before it starts to get a little more cookie cutter after that.
Before they cross the Mason-Dixon line.
Before that point, yes. But it's, you know, this is a point in the movie when the more like conventional arc of it hasn't really set in yet. And you're just kind of left with these two main characters and many other people to interact with each other. And you get a little more sense of these people just kind of being real at that point.
So
maybe that's what you're getting
at. Well, so this is what I'm getting at. And I'm not trying to defend the races, beliefs that anybody has in this movie, but the depiction of how people choose to show their racism, I think is so much more realistic. I think it's more realistic of the time that it was done and also with how, quite frankly, I think racism still persists today,
which
is that it's done oftentimes in code, sometimes speaking different languages, even in front of people that you have racist opinions about. Mm-hmm. I know that having grown up bilingual, that there is a thing that happens when you know another language, that you use that other language as a way to communicate around people that can't understand you. So I use the word incredible because I felt like it was really tapped into something, which is that racism has a way of existing all over, but it's very subtle when it happens.
Yeah, this movie portrays microaggressions in a way that Crash does not.
Yes, but I think also not even just by comparison.
Not
with
even
Crash,
just comparison.
Like I think it actually does it in a pretty good way.
Yeah, it's like what I'm saying is that Crash pretends that everybody's just always like saying any unfiltered like racist like sludge that comes out of their brain and then out of their mouth, just spewing it everywhere. And it ignores the reality of racism being a lot of these small moments that you're referring to.
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing that Green Book does is it's not constantly just people being outwardly racist towards each other. It's these very small actions that are microaggressions that build up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I also noticed that throughout the film, when people are displaying their racist feelings, that they never address them to the people themselves. Mm-hmm. They always find another person to direct their feelings towards, which again, having lived the years that I have, that's something that in watching it, I was like, the filmmakers do have their fingers on the pulse of how this type of thing happens. And I think that it's something that is very unsettling and uncomfortable to watch. Mm-hmm. But does it feel oddly accurate from a movie that feels very cookie cutter? It kind of does to me.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, often throughout the film, Tony he's looked at as like, I mean, he is an employee of Don's.
Yes.
But because of where much of the movie takes place in the Deep South in the early 1960s, oftentimes he's almost looked at as like the babysitter is probably the most PC word for it.
Right.
In that, like, a white person will go to Tony and be like, talk some sense into him.
Exactly.
You and I, we're both white. We both get it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get it. Like, you know, you have power over him, which is not true.
It's not true. But
there's this assumption like, you and I, you know, wink, wink. Like, exactly. We get it.
Yep.
It's established early on, too, that Don Shirley is this much more high-cultured person than Tony Lip is.
Extremely well-educated.
Yeah. Extremely well-educated, well-spoken, and, you know, that he's always, like, you know, well, I'm stumbling on my words a little bit here, but that he, well, I think one of the key details that establishes that throughout the film, not just in the beginning, is the way that he helps Tony writing his letters back to his wife, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Dolores.
Yeah, played by Linda Cardellini, of Freaks and Geeks fame.
Yes.
But, so that's like one of the persistent examples of how Don Shirley, you know, supposedly helps to culture Tony Lip.
Mm-hmm.
He also kind of pulls a My Fair Lady, like, oh, we're going to do these like exercises, like speech exercises to try to fix your weird accent.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Something about Betty and butter. Yep.
Yeah. Butter.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, outside of any trappings of class or external perceptions of race, just as people, Don Shirley is the one who really has the upper hand.
Yeah. And I think that throughout a lot of the movie, the filmmakers kind of know that and keep him at the upper hand up until just about the very end of the film.
Yeah.
He does have the upper hand. And one detail that I love, and I thought this was just very effective, and in that scene where they're throwing chicken wings out of the car window.
Yeah.
The Tony character, he is like, oh, wow, great. I've got him on my side now. He's willing to throw something out onto the road. But then he goes and he throws his cup. That's where Don Shirley draws the line. Mm-hmm.
Can I tell you that I watched that scene and I said, Emilio's gonna love this moment. I don't know why I was immediately like, this moment is gonna work for Emilio.
Yeah, and how does it make you feel that it worked for me?
I'm like, I'm vindicated.
Yeah,
no, but I like that touch. There are little touches throughout this movie that they don't paint him like he is some shrinking violet or some guy who just has to suddenly fall under the thumb of this other person.
Yeah, he's the boss.
He is the boss. And that detail to me kind of stuck out, and it's done in subtle ways.
It's interesting because, like, well, when we talked about Coda, I said that of the three Oscars that movie won, which I think are actually almost the same as Green Book, it's picture, supporting actor, and in Coda's case, it was adapted screenplay, Green Book's original. I think the win that I, you know, if I had to agree with any particular Oscar win, the one I most agreed with was supporting actor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Mahershala Ali is a great supporting actor.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great actor, period. Yeah. But he had won the same award 2 years before from Moonlight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's Moonlight, I think, much better movie. And I think that win at that time was really seen as this great step forward, which it was.
Yeah.
But then him winning again 2 years later for a different kind of movie just felt a little lazy on the Academy's part.
I'm not going to argue with this win because I do think this is a good performance from him. But I mean, my pick here would be Richard E. Grant.
Same.
He's so good in Can You Ever Forgive Me? He is amazing in that movie. And this is another like seasoned actor that really has been overlooked time and time again. So honestly, I look at this and I'm like, if I was able to choose, that would have been my vote.
Yeah,
I didn't see that movie, but I heard good things.
I love Richard E. Grant just in general. Like With Nell and I is such an amazing movie. And yet, just like you said, Richard E. Grant has been overlooked for such a long time. And statistically, was there a chance he would win that? Probably not. But the fact that he even got nominated, I think, is great.
We should do a close-up on Richard E. Grant.
Oh, we should, When we find the theme for it, it's
go for it. I couldn't pick him out of a lineup, but I'm down to watch whatever he's in.
Yeah.
If you guys say so,
I think you'd really enjoy Richard E. Grant.
Wonderful actor.
Cool.
And, I mean, you know, it's a pretty decent pool, that supporting actor category that year, where you have Mahershala Ali and Richard E. Grant up against Adam Driver in Black Klansman, Sam Elliott in A Star is Born, and Sam Rockwell in Vice. But, you know, I guess, you know, this brings me a little bit back into, like, some of the status of, you know, Green Book's Oscar success because, well, I mean, Emilio, I think you said earlier, like, it winning Best Picture is the worst thing that happened to it.
I think it was one of the worst things that happened to this movie, for sure.
I think that, I mean, I'm sure some of the scrutiny it received is deserved, but if it hadn't been propelled to this platform, it probably wouldn't have received quite the same scrutiny.
Yeah.
You know, I'm pulling out Oscar Wars now, but a quote just about Moonlight's win 2 years before and in the context of all the controversy that happened around it with the envelope gaffe. And yet Moonlight's win a year after Oscar's So White signaled that something had changed. It wasn't just the Academy that the Academy had welcomed new members or demoted a minuscule number of old ones. It is, in its unassuming way, Moonlight had scrambled the definition of what a Best Picture looked like. It reflected an America that had never seen itself in a movie, much less on the Oscar stage. 5 or 6 years earlier, if Moonlight had come out, there wouldn't have been a push by the studio, Boone Isaacs says. That's Cheryl Boone Isaacs, the Oscars president, Academy president at the time. It would have mattered if it was a good movie or not, but it just wouldn't have been in the paradigm. So, you know, 2 years after this incredibly progressive win for Best Picture, for the Academy to go back to some kind of like resting on its laurels with Green Book, I mean, I think that accounts for a lot of the disappointment.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And I think that it's wildly inconsistent what wins, like what qualifies a Best Picture. I can say very firmly that this is not the movie to win. I mean, it's kind of one of the reasons why I think a book like that or the subject matter of a book like that would have interested a writer like Michael Shulman.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you pin this stuff down? Oh, and yes, man. It's like there is a voting body that is predominantly white and predominantly male. How do you account for the fact that literally 2 years before, this very different movie with, I think, a different handle on sensitive subject matter, it receives the same accolade?
Yeah, and then, well, it brings me to another quote from Oscar Wars, and it's a chapter titled Tokens. It tells the stories of three black actors who were awarded acting awards, supporting and main, across the years, and those three actors are Hattie McDaniel, who won supporting actress for Gone with the Wind, Sidney Poitier, who won best actor for Lilies of the Field, and Halle Berry, who won Best Actress.
I was just going to say Halle Berry
Monsters Ball.
Yeah.
But there's a quote at the end of that chapter that I think sums up those circumstances and broader Academy circumstances well. And it says, for McDaniel, for Poitier, for Berry, the Oscar came to symbolize not progress, but false promise. A chance for Hollywood to congratulate itself and then go back to business as usual while the winner was left isolated and open to public attack.
I definitely think that this is an example of that.
Yeah. I mean, I what I kept thinking throughout this is that, you know, we're talking about, like, how can this possibly happen? I mean, it mirrors our own society, you know, like, how does Barack Obama win, you know, the presidency two times in a row and then Trump win? Like, it's like you start to make progress, like, one step forward, two steps back.
Well, I was even thinking as an analogy earlier that, like, these wins for Crash and Green Book are almost like the Oscars equivalent of losing the popular vote and winning the Electoral College.
I like that.
It's as though Moonlight, not the movie itself, but the winning of Best Picture was this self-congratulation for progress by Hollywood, and then Green Book is the business as usual.
Yeah. I would totally agree.
In talking about the more redeeming qualities of Green Book, I mean, I think there are things that are done well about it. Emilio, the way you described it, portraying microaggressions, I think that is a good quality that it has. It's a little more real about that. For the most part, acting is pretty good in that movie.
I think that's one of the other real strengths. I mean, they do so much of the work in this film to really get us on both of their sides.
Yeah.
There's some aspects to the writing that I think it feels underwritten. There's a lot of depth that this movie only hints at that it doesn't really dig into, which if this were to have another pass at a draft, they would hopefully address some of that. But but I think that the actors really elevate what is written to a place where it feels eminently watchable and that they feel very relatable. I think that that's one of the strengths, oddly, of this film.
Talking about the writing, I mean, there's some scenes where the dialogue I actually thought was quite good. There are other scenes where I thought it was, you know, just fine.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, where, you know, when you say another draft could have done it better, I do agree with that. Yeah, so when you look at it, winning original screenplay, yeah, like, I don't think I would have given that.
Nor would I.
I mean, there's other good nominees there. There's The Favorite, First Reformed, Roma, Vice. Of that bunch, I mean, I think I might have given it to The Favorite. First Reformed's a great nominee, though.
I was going to say First Reformed is probably where I would go.
First Reformed is like the Richard E. Grant of that category.
Okay.
It's like, it's the only Oscar it was nominated for, I think, but very deservingly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I'm thinking back to the Oscars night itself that Green Book had that, not sweep, but, you know, it had that success.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It had success.
And I remember that, like, you know, in light of all the controversy that happened when Samuel L. Jackson and Brie Larson were presenting the awards for both original and adapted screenplays, that Samuel L. Jackson opened up the envelope for original, and you could see when he saw it was Green Book, he's kind of like, oh, okay.
Well, the same thing happened with Julia Roberts when she, she announced the
Best Picture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that just, again, just feels very weird about this movie winning. I actually went back to listen to the acceptance speech. It feels really odd. It feels like a bunch of people that know that they're under a magnifying glass and that they cannot say the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Very tellingly, they did not thank Don Shirley in their acceptance. And I don't know whether that is a true reflection of what drove them to make this film, but like watching it, it feels very strange. And again, I think this movie, it should not have been in this position.
Yeah.
It should not have.
And interestingly, I mean, I noted that Octavia Spencer was a producer on this movie. So, yeah, she's obviously an exception to that rule, and she is an Oscar winner herself. But for a movie that also has like some questionable qualities, The Help.
It's interesting. She was very proud of this movie when it came out.
Green Book.
Yeah, she was very proud of it. And I think it actually speaks to something that I also felt was one of the odd strengths of this movie. Now, this has been debated by Don Shirley's family, but one of the things that I couldn't help but think of was what felt like a little bit of a comparison of Shirley to Sammy Davis Jr. And there's not a comparison that the film was making, but one that in watching the film, I couldn't help but think. And I've read up a bunch about Sammy Davis Jr. and how he was at this strange intersection of not feeling quote-unquote black enough, not quote-unquote being white. He was not the most quote-unquote masculine of the Rat Pack. And apparently people who were close to him talked about how it was something that deeply bothered him and that he did a lot of things behind the scenes to try to help the civil rights movement, but he did not feel like he was in a position to be a forward-facing member. And that idea of a complicated black man, maybe these are not the people to tell that story, but this is something that Octavia Spencer talked about. She was like, this is something that I think needs to be seen more. This is something that Mahershala Ali talked about as well. He was like, I love that this is a complicated person, that this is not a character that fits easily in a box. And I think that the movie does, again, not the best job, but it does a fair job of portraying some of those things.
Yeah.
Not like I want to give the movie a ton of points for that, but I don't want to take away a bunch of points for it, like for the movie either.
Mahershala Ali individually does a good job of portraying a lot of those qualities in Don Shirley. You know, it's even when the screenplay just feels a little bit narrower, you know, you still get the sense that he is doing his best work there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, yeah, a lot to think about there.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you know, if you want, like, good examples in very recent experience of complicated black characters being portrayed on film. I thought of American Fiction.
Sure, yeah.
That movie has some very common ground with the book Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison.
Yeah, which is a really good book.
Yeah, but it's which is about, among many things, that theme.
Exactly.
That, you know, this black protagonist of that book cannot be seen as a full human being.
Sure.
Hence the invisibility. The stuff, the material is out there for portraying this kind of narrative with nuance and dignity, to use words I've used a lot in this conversation. But just is Green Book the movie to portray that? Probably not.
I that's fair. Yeah. I understand everyone's opinion
I feel like a lot of this, when you frame it in the context of awards being won, it's easy to put it into such binaries that you know, the true subject matter does not fall into.
Yeah. And well, I think that's the thing that happened with me was I was trying to think about it. I was like, okay, yeah, clearly not a Best Picture winner.
Yeah.
But I also just trying to think a little bit more about just it as a film.
Yeah.
Because I think that what it's won has really clouded. It's clouded a movie that I think is a little bit more nuanced than I think people initially might feel. And that's just me. That's just my read. Yeah. And I would totally agree with you. I think it's not like this is the only example of complicated portrayals of black men. But if it's done in a way that doesn't feel terribly offensive, I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
And this movie does a better job than I think it gets credit for.
Yeah.
That's my personal
opinion. I'll revise my statement from a minute ago of saying like this isn't the movie to tell that. Just say just to say that like this movie works in some ways with that.
Yeah, well, you can absolutely feel that way.
Yeah.
People can feel any way they want to about that movie.
Yeah. It's just, it's not leading the charge of that kind of
story. I would agree. Yeah. That I would absolutely
agree. Not the one to lead the charge.
I would agree with that statement for sure.
Well, I don't know about you all, but I feel like I have said much of what's on my mind about Green
Book. I have too. I think so as well.
Yeah. I've been a little more quiet in this second half. I just feel like I tuckered myself out like ranting about Crash.
And me too.
A little bit of it too.
Yeah. And I also just, I feel like, you know, I found Green Book more or less mostly inoffensive to the point that I just kind of let it wash over me. And I feel like this is a movie that I'm going to consider fairly forgettable.
It's like not, it's status quo.
It definitely is. And the weird thing is that there are a lot of status quo films that have won Best Picture.
It's, I mean, and you know, it goes back and forth over time. Though interestingly, we mentioned that it seemed like Roma may have been the favorite to win, you know, at that Oscars in 2019. And that's an interesting point considering the movie that won the following year, which was Parasite, which we've all said was a very deserving winner. And
a swing. It's a real swing there. Business as usual, patting themselves on the back. Yeah.
Well, Roma, I mean, you know, it's like if that had won Best Picture, that would have been a progressive move for an international feature film to finally win the top prize, which Parasite did 1 year later.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like you said, the cycle goes back and forth. Although, you know, with Everything Everywhere All at Once following
Coda.
Parasite, you know, pretty closely in time, you know, maybe the tide's turning a little bit more. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say.
Perhaps
this year's Oscars will tell us something more to that effect.
Yeah.
You listening to this, know this.
Yeah.
I think this is a perfectly good time to end this conversation.
Yeah, I think that we have put everything out there that we need to about these two movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I have any other thoughts, and I'm going to move on with my life. I have decided to not be a hater in 2024, and I'm not going to continue to waste mental energy on hating Crash. I want to be clear that I do hate it, but I'm not going to think about how much I hate it anymore.
It will just live in this recording, and it doesn't need to go anywhere
else. And then I will be done. Yeah. And
on Letterboxd.
Yeah. And I do not hate Green Book. I do not like it, but I'm moving forward with my life.
Yep. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I think we're not going to do Unlikely Shared Universe for this episode. It feels like
I think it feels like a strange
I don't think
we need to do a shared universe. I just did find it very interesting, and you guys probably know this as people who are way bigger fans of The Sopranos than I am, but like Tony Lip in real life did go on to be an actor.
Yeah, he did.
With some interesting credits.
Yeah, some very interesting credits.
The Sopranos and Goodfellas. And like, so
I think The Godfather, if I'm not
mistaken. The Godfather too, as like a waiter or something.
Yeah, and well, I mean, that's actually a great transition into discussing what we're going to talk about the next time we come together.
Yes, sir.
Because one of the films we've discussed was loosely mentioned just there. And so the next time we come together for our close-up segment, we are going to talk about a unique presence in the Best Picture category from around 50 years ago. And this is the late, great actor John Cazale, who in a short but very interesting filmography where he appeared in 3 Best Picture winners in the short span of just 6 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the 3 movies we're going to discuss with him, only 2 of them won the award, but the 3rd was nominated. Those 3 are The Godfather Part 2, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Deer Hunter.
That sounds good. I'm excited.
I have a lot of movies to watch in the next couple weeks. Yeah.
Worth noting, too, Godfather Part 2 and The Deer Hunter, long movies.
Yeah. And Godfather 2. I feel like I need to watch The Godfather
as well. Even if we're not going to discuss the first Godfather, I do plan on watching it. I can't just rewatch 2.
I might do the same, at least to get the Fredo scenes from it.
Totally.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thank you for the suggestion on this, Julian.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, totally. As much as these, you know, one movie was middling and one I flat out hated, I am grateful for the knowledge that I have acquired by experiencing all of this.
Absolutely. I feel the same way.
I actually, as much as I hated Crash, I had fun talking about it.
Same here. Same here.
Same here.
The goal. And I hope that you guys had fun listening to it.
Absolutely.
If you want to follow us on Instagram, we are at Sleepless Cinematic Pod. If you'd like to email us, we are at sleeplesscinematicpod@gmail.com. If you'd like to follow myself or Julian on Letterboxd, I am at Patroness of Cats.
I am at Julian Barthold, just my name, or Julian_Barthold.
And one of these days, I'll get a letterbox.
Yeah. One of us.
All right, guys. Good night. It's pretty late. We'll take care. All right. Bye-bye.